You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends in the Sunshine State of Florida, right here in Coco. I wanted to use the word sunshine today because it's beautiful outside.
It is.
We are on FM 94.7, FM 99.9, FM 100.7, and AM 1510, and our dials are WWBC. We are also heard live on the web. Ellen and I are here every Monday. This studio, this beautiful studio that I am so blessed to be part of every Monday, is like an extension of my living room where I get to come here and do what I love, which is talk. Because my husband won't talk. So this is like an extension of my living room, and we're grateful that Paul gives us the opportunity and produces our show, runs the board for us. He's not responsible for the content. We are. And Ellen, it's just wonderful to be here. So
it
tell
is
our
fantastic.
Listeners how to find our past shows and
yeah.
Listen,
so for the last 9 years, we've been on air, and all of our shows are archived on our website, which is www.cetamediainc.com. And we have all of our great guests. You can actually search for specific guests or search for topics right on there, and you'll hear our shows for the last 9 years. We're also on Facebook, so we share it also on Facebook as well. And We got quite a little following going on over the last 9 years.
Well, you know, it's kind of nice.
Quite a few downloads.
Yeah, it's really nice to have a good co-host too, a great co-host who helps me behind the scenes. And I think you've kind of incorporated this show into your world as well.
I have, of course. Every Monday I've been with you.
I
love the conversation that we have because I always learn something.
Me too.
Yes.
Well, you know, people tell me, well, how can you have a show that you don't tick people off? You don't get people upset. And I said, well, you know, there's something about when you speak from the heart.
That's right.
I do believe in family. I believe in faith. I believe in finances, working for your money and having a little change. I also believe in food, which I like to cook and feed my friends and family. But most important, I believe in forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Nobody's perfect. And everyone makes mistakes. So I think when you wake up every day and tell yourself that this is your purpose in life, it's okay to have a show because you're speaking from the heart.
Well, and the other part is too, is that we don't, we're not discriminatory. We listen to everybody's viewpoints that's what Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is all about, is because we have different people with different perspectives that come on.
Right.
We don't always agree.
We could. Some people might think.
We love to hear them.
Some people might think that, hey, you know, you're saying something that I don't agree with, but there's something called respect, and you could agree to disagree.
That's right.
So I think when you think like that, it's not about being a Republican or a Democrat or an independent or belonging to a Green Party. It's belonging to the human race. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have a guest in our studio today, Nick Tambolides.
Yes.
And Nick sent me the most beautiful message when I was running for office. And I will never forget. Sometimes you don't forget the people that just say a nice word or smile or were there for you when you were down and out. And I appreciated it. So, Nick, welcome to our show. We're going to have you on the second segment, but we're going to let you introduce yourself while we wait for a call-in guest to call in. So introduce yourself really quick.
Yeah, I'm Nick Tambolides, live in Coco, Florida, and I'm the executive director of U.S. Term Limits. We're the nation's oldest and largest pro-term limits group. We believe in changing, reforming our government for the better to put control back in the people's hands.
And, you know, Ellen, that's how I meet most of the people that want to come on the show, on social media, or just I'll be at the supermarket and somebody will come up to me and ask me if they could be a guest on the show, or I meet people everywhere, and not everyone can come because we have to have sponsors to pay for our shows so we Paul could keep us on air, which is really wonderful. So I think it's great that you're here. Thank you so much. And we're going to hear from him. He can join into the first segment as well.
Absolutely.
But our guest who is calling in today is calling him actually from California. So she woke up early. She is a breast. Her name is Beverly D.
Deal.
Deal. Yeah, she said to call her Beverly Deal, which is really nice for me. She's a blogger. She's a breast cancer survivor. She's an author. She's an activist. And she's going to call in and chat with us a little bit this morning about what she does. And we'll talk a little bit about voting. We'll talk a little bit about survival, as in surviving breast cancer, the guilt that goes along with it. And most important, we'll chat a little bit about healthcare versus wealth care, because we all know when you get a disease, what happens. But before I say hello to Beverly, because I know she's on the line, I just wanted to say to all the mothers out there, I hope you had a happy, healthy Mother's Day. I worked in the nursing home yesterday and brought a lot of cheer to some of my residents. And then I went home and I had cooked the night before. I made rice and stew chicken and a salad and lentils. And one daughter texted me and said she wanted shrimp. And the other texted me and said she wanted vegetarian chili. So we cooked, my husband and I, and had our children over who couldn't come. Some of them are still socially isolated. And it was good. It was a good Mother's Day.
Very nice. And happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you.
And happy Grandmother's Day, too.
Oh, yeah, I know. But you know, I think people miss the point about Mother's Day. Most mothers want time.
That's right.
They want time with their children. Mm-hmm. You know, and so for those who still have a parent who is alive, reach out to them and give them as much love if you can. People have a lot of issues in their families, too, so I can't say everyone.
Sure.
But people want time. Pick up the phone, you know, FaceTime. It broke my heart to see patients and their families still talking through the window.
Yeah.
And then we had a lot of, you know, people on FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And the good old-fashioned phone call. We had a lot of people with, you know, with calling and
good.
Stuff. So I know Beverly's on the phone. And so, Beverly, welcome to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, how's things in California right now?
Well, things in California we're pretty chill, which is, I guess, our reputation, despite there have been a few protests, but most people, you know, are, if not happy to socially isolate, are accepting that as something that we need to do. People are wearing masks in the grocery store. You know, people are not going out. It's a little weird to be in Los Angeles and not have traffic.
Well, I want to introduce you to our studio friend. My friend Ellen Little is here. She's my co-host. And my friend Nick Tambolides is here, and he's the executive director of U.S. Term Limits. And he looks very spazzy in his suit and tie. Well,
I overdressed big time.
He looks great. No, I like it.
I've even got the little flag pin.
I think it's wonderful. Why not? You know, people judge you sometimes the way you judge. You look great. So yeah, Bev, so we're all here, and we're going to ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do there in California.
Okay. So let me flog my experience in my book a little bit. So I have a book called Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll on a Tiara, which is about my breast cancer experiences. And one of the things that happened for me is my own mother passed away of breast cancer when I was 10. And so
I am sorry, Bev.
The period from Mother's Day to my birthday, which is in early June, can be emotionally difficult for me. And so when I got my breast cancer diagnosis early in May, 5 years ago, I decided one of the ways I decided to cope with it is I wore a tiara to all my medical appointments.
That's awesome.
And it reminded people to treat me like a princess, but it also created a very good positive feedback loop because people would see the tiara and they would smile. You can't help it. You see somebody wearing a tiara, you're going to smile. And so they would smile at me and I would smile back at them, and it made all the appointments and all the things that I had to do to deal with the diagnosis a little more cheerful, a little less you know, oh my God. And
yeah,
reality,
fearful. It's very fearful, and it creates a lot of anxieties too, because it is sort of like the fear of the unknown. You're not sure which way it's going to go.
No, you don't know. I mean, I think probably every human being knows someone who had a really horrific experience with cancer. However, we've learned a lot, and it is not a death sentence anymore. And it's, you know, I was blessed. I had breast cancer light. So I did not have to go through the physical extremes that a lot of people did. But I did have to go through some emotional stuff because I was kind of following in my mother's footprints. So so a tiara helps. I advise anyone dealing with a health crisis of whatever kind to get some kind of talisman that helps you. It can be a lucky rabbit's foot keychain. It can be special earrings. It can be whatever. But have something that is like, this is going to give me the extra power to deal with this.
Yeah, and you're an accountant as well. That's your day job, correct?
My day job is I work for an accounting firm. I'm not actually a CPA. I do support for that. I teach people how to use QuickBooks. I'm a notary public.
Oh, wonderful. So you know how it felt to have the diagnosis, and then you have to say to yourself, my goodness, now I have to worry about healthcare. How did you cope with that? Because, I mean, most people, their healthcare is deducted, their premiums are deducted from their checks. What happens when you are sick and now you're worried about that? I mean, that must have been an experience that, you know, not just you, but so many people all over the United States worry about when that diagnosis comes down.
Well, I was very lucky in that my company gives a really good health care benefit package. However, I will say this. I have like what they would call a Cadillac package. There's a ton that my company pays in for. I pay extra to bump it up to the next level. And yet still, I had to have a bunch of diagnostic tests and blood work and blah, blah stuff done last year. And I'm in the process of paying off over $3,000 in out-of-pocket medical costs, even with a Cadillac plan.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they said at some point the United States, all of us, we're going to have to address employer-sponsored insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, private public insurance, and do something so that people, when they're diagnosed with such a terminal disease, they don't have to worry about healthcare, but they can worry about getting well, you know, because I can see that happening to not just you, but so many people. So, I mean, so you mentioned that, you know, the epiphany of Black Beauty, that, and I read Black Beauty when I was a child, and I remember that story and how Black Beauty just rose from everything to show all of us that if you believe in yourself and you have self-confidence, what can happen. But you said that Black Beauty helped you to reframe and rethink your ideas about body image, health, and compassion. Tell us a little bit about how you use one of our childhood favorites to help you.
Okay, so there's a scene in Black Beauty. So Black Beauty is a horse. And the horse goes through from being a colt to being this kind of horse to being a living. He ends up being a cart horse. He's hauling heavy loads. And there's a scene in the book where he hasn't been fed well. He hasn't been treated well for some time. So his little horse body is run down. And he's trying to pull a cart up a very heavy cart that's too heavy for him, up a steep hill that's covered with ice. And he can't do it. And he falls. And instead of helping him, lighten the load, leading him, the carter takes his whip and starts beating him and yelling at him to get up. And my epiphany was, this is how a lot of us treat our own bodies. We don't feed them well enough. We don't rest them well enough. We give them too much that's too heavy to carry. And then when they break down, instead of saying, oh, let me show you some compassion, let me help you, we beat up on ourselves, and we tell ourselves, get up, do this, even when there's no more there there. And I think we all have to learn to show ourselves more compassion.
Right. Well, you know, that could be an entire show. I Nick, have you read Black Beauty?
I think I do recall reading it when I was younger.
Scene.
Yeah.
Have you read it,
Oh,
Ellen?
Absolutely, yeah.
I remember that scene because we all cried when the horse got whipped.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, that ties into like a bigger, we can have a whole show on how people put their, put wealth before health.
Yes.
Because we are what we eat, breed, think. We really are. And a lot of us don't think about it till we actually get sick. Like, I know a lot of, I'm a nurse, and I see a lot of people that now they'd say, well, I'm going to cut down on salt. But they cut down on salt after they're diagnosed with hypertension. Or they'll cut down on eating a lot of sweets and sugars after they've diagnosed with diabetes. Well, somehow, somewhere, we lost a memo that we should be doing that from little children, because it's going to catch up with all of us. And I'm one of those that have to cut back on salt now. Mm-hmm. Because I eat a lot of food with salt. And so my blood pressure is a little high.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you're right about that. We have to take care of our bodies. So when you talk about survivor's guilt, I mean, it's not just for cancer survivors, but for so many people who just feel like they did not take care of themselves, and they're worried, did I deserve this? And now we're seeing that a lot of people are having survivor's guilt, even with COVID-19. So what are some of the ways that you coped with survivor's guilt?
Well, I think it's important to realize that just because you have cancer and you got off easier, you had COVID-19 and you got off easier, you had a car accident and you got off easy compared to other people, there is no amount of suffering that you could have endured that would have made things better for anyone else. You know, it's not like if you know, this person who has permanent lung damage, let's say, it's not like if I had permanent lung damage too, that would make their lives any better. We don't deserve what we get. We don't deserve the families that we're born into. We don't.
I know about that. We have some in our family that others don't speak with or to or whatever. I mean, you can choose your friends. You can't choose your family, right?
No, you can't choose your family. And you know, guilt isn't helpful. Gratitude is helpful. Gratitude is saying, okay, what was I given, and how can I use this to help others who are less fortunate? But just feeling bad, it's kind of, it's almost like humble bragging, you know?
Yes.
It doesn't help anyone. So we have to learn. It's normal to be to look at ourselves and say, I got off lucky and I didn't deserve it. You know, what makes me better than this woman 2 doors down? Nothing makes you better. But you can perhaps use what you've been given to help others.
Right. And you started blogging, and you wrote a few books. Tell our listening audience on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends about your books, and where can we find them?
Well, my books and my short stories. First off, my website is BeverlyDiehl.
I went this morning on your website and I saw 2 breasts with flowers on them, and I thought, "Ooh, my conservative friends are probably not going to like this." But then you have to understand it's about breast cancer and it's part of the human body.
Yes, yes. So my book and my blog in places has boob pictures. One of the things that I did after I got diagnosed, and I didn't know, you know, was I going to lose 1 breast? Was I going to lose 2 breasts? Was I going to keep them? Were they going to be different? Is I went and I had one of those bucket list things, and I did a boudoir shoot.
Good for you. Good for you, Bev. I'm glad you did that.
And that was another thing that really made me feel like, you know, you can see yourself through somebody else's eyes. And I had always not liked my body, and not like, you know, you can nitpick yourself to death, but I actually felt beautiful, and I shared some of those pictures on my blog and in my book, and I have also have some of the scarier pictures from when I was having radiation, and I had like second-degree burns in a few places where it blistered, and you know, it's a range of experiences. The book itself, you can find links on my website, or there's a site called Books to Read, B-O-O-K-S, the number 2, the word read.com/, and Bev's Boobs.
Yes.
Will take you to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Smashwords, wherever you like to get books, you can get it.
Well, you know, now that you said that, I just ran into a young woman who has colon cancer, and she is about 40 years old. Her husband has a really high-powered job. He travels a lot. And she has cancer, and she's going to have a colostomy. And she's going through exactly what you just described. Why me? The guilt. The body image. And so people understand, whether it's the breast or the colon, or maybe you have bone cancer, maybe you have cancer of the eye. I've had somebody who had their eye removed because of cancer. It can change your life, and people have to learn to cope with it. I mean, a young person having to have a colostomy and having it's about how that's something that a woman doesn't want to have in bed or with her friends. And she felt as though her life was over. So I'm glad you said that, because I will send her to your website to read that book, and maybe she can get some information on how to cope. But just to transition a little bit from that, we talked this morning, you and I, about COVID-19 and healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so many people who are diagnosed with COVID-19, some of them have money to hire someone to help them with household chores, help them with driving, taking care of their meals, whatever. But there's so many people that don't. So, Bev, I mean, how do we differentiate this? And how is it fair that some people have the finances to help and some don't? So is COVID-19 going to sort of give us an idea of, when people say survival of the fittest, is that really true, you think?
Or survival of the richest.
Right.
More like, I think that, you know, the United States is one of the last first world countries, maybe we're not even a first world country anymore, that doesn't have single payer or universal health care for its people. And I think we need to get there. I mean, it's great that I have great health care, even though I still have to pay a boatload for it. But what if my job was awful? What if I wanted to leave my job? The idea that you're chained perhaps to a terrible job because it has good health care, and somebody in your family is sick and or has had cancer, or one of your kids has, and you can't leave that job. Or the idea that, you know, you'll take whatever job you can get because you have to feed your kids, but there is no benefits, there's no health care. You know, what do you do? I mean, we have right now a lot of people before COVID-19 who would only go to the emergency room in a dire emergency and wouldn't get regular maintenance health care for themselves or their families.
Right, and I think that's why they were affected, because a lot of people who did not get a checkup didn't know they had a heart condition. They didn't know they had hypertension. They didn't know they had neurological problems. So when they got the respiratory illness, it affected other systems as well.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of the people right now who are getting sick are healthcare workers who were being exposed in the early stages of this disease without proper protective gear. It's scary times. And again, we depend too much in this country on poor people and generally people of color to do nursing work, to do janitorial work, to do work that places them at risk.
Front lines. I tell you, we talked about this yesterday with a few friends of ours, the people who are working in the restaurants, the people who are cleaning the hospitals, the people who are mowing the lawns in front of the healthcare places. There, you're right, is Hispanics, people of color, they don't have the luxury of working from home on a computer where they are socially distanced properly. They have to go into actual physical labor to work.
My niece is a medical worker, and she's working in one of the hospitals in Milwaukee, which, of course, is seeing another uptick in COVID-19 cases. But she's working in one of the hospitals where they did not have protective gear to give to the environmental staff, the people that clean the hospital rooms and the bathrooms and everything. These people were going into these rooms of people who had been very sick of this and having to clean them without having proper protective gear. We have to have gear for everybody. We have to have health care for everybody. You know, one of the stories that I was reading about a woman in Detroit who was a, I forget, the people who draw the blood, what do you call them?
Phlebotomist.
The phlebotomist. So she was a phlebotomist for this medical system for like 30-odd years. She didn't have good medical. She went to the ER of, you know, the hospital where she worked, and they turned her away without tests. 2-3 times.
Well, COVID-19 sure is exposing, you know, all the discrepancies and shortcomings in healthcare. We're all seeing that. But we only have a minute left. And I know we had, if you could quickly tell me, I know in California that voting by mail is easy, as well as different states. It's widely adopted in other states. Tell our audience really quick in a minute or so why it's important to actually vote, and vote by mail if you can, because it's important. This election is going to be important.
Well, voting means that you are deciding who is making the laws that affect you, who impacts rent and mortgages in your area, who has regulates the restaurants or doesn't. You know, it's who is on the school board that decides what your children are learning in school. All those things are impacted by voting, and if you can vote by mail, do it. It's easy. You can vote in stages. You can look up the judges' races and Google each of the judges and you know, take your time and fill out your ballot a little bit at a time when you vote by mail.
Well, thank you, Bev. I know Ellen was listening and Nick is listening, and we're so grateful. Give us the website one more time for people to look at your books and maybe buy a couple of them and get some ideas how to cope with illnesses. And I really appreciate your friendship, and I appreciate your feedback on Facebook with me as well.
I enjoy interacting with you on Facebook, and thank you for having me today. My website is beverlydiehl.com.
And we also have the books, the books website that you had given us, as well as Amazon. I posted that all on our Facebook page underneath our post for today's show. So thank you so much for being with us.
Beverly's so calm.
I
feel like you're sitting here in the studio with us. You're so calm. So thank you for all you do. And I'm glad you're still on planet Earth with us. Keep enjoying your journey.
I'm glad I am too. And you guys have a great day. And thank you again for having me and talking with me.
All right. What a great segment. Great first segment there from with Beverly Deal. But we're going to take a quick minute and listen to some sponsor ads, and then we'll be right back with Nick.
Yes.
Just a Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9. That's Cloud number 9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9, mattress and furniture. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 8 locations serving Brevard County. So if you have an emergency, need a physical, or when your doctor is unavailable, with 8 locations, MedFast offers top quality care that is close by and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. MEDFAST Urgent Care opens 7 days a week with the convenience of 8 locations serving Brevard County. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MEDFAST. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With 3 locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345. Located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne, that's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends here on WWBC AM 1510, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. And we're also online. And, you know, Ellen, we have a really great first segment. Robust, yes. I should say. It makes you think. It really makes you think. As women, you know, body image means everything to us. People spend so much money to get Botox and... Now they're all going, I wouldn't say crazy, because words do matter, like Paul made me realize. Paul, words do matter. But they want to get their hair done.
Yeah.
They want to look pretty again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not about being pretty on the outside. It's about being pretty on the inside, too.
That's right.
And she made us see that she wore her tiara so she can cope with the diagnosis of breast cancer and what comes with it.
Yes. And all of her information is posted on her Facebook page under CETA Media, Inc. So you can get in touch with Beverly Deal and connect with her. She's got a very robust blog, and very honest, from the heart, raw.
Yeah.
Really,
and we,
really great.
And now we have a really cool guest in studio with us, and I'll let you do the honors. He's really dressed nice. I love it.
Yeah.
Actually, everybody that comes to our studio wears pretty good clothes.
Yeah.
We don't have any ragamuffins to just waltz in like that.
I'm glad I didn't bring my Grateful Dead t-shirt.
There you go.
That would have been nice. Yeah, that's my.
So tell our listeners about our guest.
Nick Tumbleedies.
Close enough. Yeah,
now,
Tumbleedies.
Tumbleedies, right. He's executive director of U.S. Term Limits. It's the nation's oldest and largest pro-term limits group. Under his leadership, they've expanded its great grassroots network to a record high and won campaigns at 98%. which is fantastic. And there's a website, of course. It is www.termlimits.com. So if you want to check that out while you're listening here to our interview with Nick, please do that. All of our listeners out there, welcome, Nick. Thanks.
Great to be here.
And we're going to have a serious discussion with Nick about term limits because, you know, I posted it on my Facebook before I left, and I got tons of private messages, and I had such a discussion going. I know Nick will have to take a look at it later.
Yeah, so how did you get started? I mean, this is not, right? You were talking about college and...
Yeah, so, you know, I was more of like a conventional political activist for a while, you know, working on different causes that I believed in. And what I eventually started to realize was that you can't really get anything done in politics if the system itself is corrupt. If you have institutional corruption where the elected officials are only looking out for their own self-serving motives, you know, they're trying to keep power, they're trying to keep their jobs rather than actually do their jobs, then that will create not only kind of this inertia in government where nothing gets done, but it also creates this extreme hyper-partisanship and dysfunction that we see in Washington, D.C., where the modus operandi of every legislator is to just demonize everyone else, blame the other side for everything that is wrong with America, you know, convince your base that you're doing the right things. But in the meantime, nothing ever really gets solved. You know, we have so many problems in this country that we've entrusted to career politicians. We have a broken immigration system. We have a broken healthcare system. We're just winding down.
Housing.
Like, housing.
Oh my God.
Is a huge issue.
I mean, you're right.
Now, you know, and we've now got this this COVID-19 thing, and you know, so many problems that they have not addressed that they should have foreseen beforehand. But I think they were too preoccupied with just keeping their own power and climbing up that ladder. And so, what we're saying is, why don't we get back to basics? Why don't we go back to a citizen legislature?
Like, why are you running for office?
Yeah, like Abe Lincoln.
Tell us, like, what did you see wrong in
but
your neighborhood?
But it shouldn't cost $2.5 million for someone to run for office.
Exactly.
Which tells
right.
you already that it's corrupt.
Yeah, that's one problem. We have government that doesn't really look like...
Say the number again. $2.5 million to run for a Senate seat.
For a U.S. House seat. Senate is more expensive.
Oh,
you know,
Lord.
You see some Senate races where it takes $50 million
yes,
to
right,
win a Senate seat.
For my simple
such
little,
a waste of money.
For my seat, just a state rep seat, they were telling me, and you have to collect $100,000 or more. Like, really?
Yeah.
All right.
It's crazy. So what you have is you have this huge barrier to entry where if there's an incumbent in Congress, this person has all the advantages in the world. It takes $2.5 million on average, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, to dethrone that person. And that has the effect of locking millions of ordinary Americans out of the political process. You know, you look, we have a population in this country of 330 million people. You know, we're the most educated, wealthy country in the history of the world. And yet we're told by the ruling class in Washington that these 535 people are the only ones qualified to represent us in Congress. I'm sorry, I just don't buy that. I think that is a joke. I know so many people from so many different backgrounds who could do a better job. And what we're saying with term limits is give them a chance. Give the American people a chance. Get back to what Lincoln said, government of, by, and for the people.
Yeah, but the argument would be, like, for example, I like Congressman John Lewis, right? So what would happen if somebody says to you, well, then what happens to somebody like him when he has a cast a vote?
Right.
People feel as though he is still representing them.
Well, it's interesting dynamic because you've got the American people tend to reelect their member of Congress, and yet they disapprove of Congress. You know, Congress hasn't had a positive approval rating in 16 years. You know, 60% of people say they would fire every single member of Congress if they could. They're less popular than root canals and traffic jams and head lice. And you ask, like, well, why do people keep reelecting politicians that they can barely stand? And the reason being is they tend not to have another choice because incumbents manage to stack the deck to keep competition away. You know, if an incumbent has $10 million in their pack, they have all the name recognition in the world. You know, that you have gerrymandering, you have free media coverage if you're an incumbent. You know, that is a huge wall. That is a wall that Donald Trump would envy that is built around these incumbents so that people from outside, you know, anti-establishment candidates can't penetrate it, can't unseat these incumbent members of Congress. And so you see a lack of competition across the political spectrum. We tend to think that people want these long-term incumbents to just come back over and over again. I don't think that's the case. I think it's the system that is preventing us from making the changes that we want.
There's a huge problem with money in politics. And when people leave their job as a state rep or in the Senate or whatever, then they go into another one, which is a lobbyist.
Right.
I mean, so we have a problem. And then whose interests are they really representing?
Yeah.
They're representing who gives them that huge paycheck.
Exactly right. You know, and what we see from corporate PACs, we're talking about how difficult it is for an ordinary American to run for office. Well, the corporate PACs, they give $9 in contributions to the incumbent for every $1 they give to the challenger. So how is an average citizen supposed to compete in a system that is that rigged? You need to do something to break up the monopoly, and term limits does that. Term limits says, look, every 6 years or every 8 years, we're going to hit the reset button. We're going to get someone in here who can change the system before it changes them, and not worry so much about political consequences, not worry so much about getting reelected or catering to those donors and lobbyists, but worry about actually doing the right thing, solving the big problems that our country has.
Well, didn't these people have jobs before they became a politician? There's nothing wrong with getting a job in the private sector and filling out an application like all of us do. Get our fingerprints taken, get our blood test done, and they say, you're hired.
Right.
What are they so afraid of? I mean, is it because I know when I ran for office.
Well, it's comfortable, I think. They get in that role, and that's what they kind of stick with. That's my thought about the whole thing.
You could be right, but I know when I ran for office, people would say, well, you can't win because the candidate is an establishment candidate.
Right.
He's got name recognition. He's got money. So that means a person who actually care about affordable housing, health care, proper wages, whether your children have a teacher in school, that the ratio is, you know, that a teacher can teach per child, like 22 to a class is a lot, I think, right? Mm-hmm. So I was concerned about those things. And so a person like me who actually care wouldn't get in, Nick, because of the word establishment.
Right. Yeah, you know, every candidate will run for office saying that Washington is a swamp, but then once they get there, they realize it's a lot more like a hot tub, and it's comfortable.
Like a nursing home.
Yeah, and they, or like a nursing home, and they never want to leave. You know, they fall in love with the trappings of office. You think about it. You know, they're getting $174,000 a year. When we have a shutdown like COVID-19, it's not members of Congress who are getting furloughed and fired. It's, you know, hardworking people.
Yes.
Those checks are still coming in. They have a Cadillac pension plan. You know, they have a
gym.
They have a pharmacy. They have a barber shop. They have free parking at the airport.
Their kids get free schooling.
Yes.
But Nick, how do we change
it? They have 220 paid days off every year.
But how do we change it? Because we have our congressman, Bill Posey. He's been there forever.
Yes.
And, I mean, I have nothing against him if he's doing a good job, right? If he is, if he isn't, I'm not going to say one way or the other on viewpoint with CETA and Frenzy.
Right.
I like him. He's a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Who has enough money to run against him?
Nobody does. And that's why you rarely see competition in our political system right now. You know, a lot of folks will come to me and they'll say, well, why don't you just vote out your incumbent? And I'll give you a little anecdote. When I moved to Brevard County for the first time, Supervisor of Elections sent me a ballot in the mail, and I looked for the House of Representatives race. I think it might have been District 52 at the time, Rich Workman, and it wasn't on the ballot. It was not on the ballot. So I actually called the supervisor's office, and I said, you guys have actually made a mistake here. You left a race off my ballot. You got to fix it. And she said, oh, no, there's no mistake. Nobody was running against the incumbent, so that election was canceled. So I had no opportunity to exercise my voting rights.
Even if you wanted to write in somebody's name.
In that race.
Yeah.
And I wanted to find out, you know, how widespread is that? And it's extremely widespread. Before we had term limits in Florida, over half of all the elections in the state were canceled every 2 years, which means people had no opportunity to vote because no one was willing to challenge these incumbents. It's been minimized since we passed term limits. But in Congress, you got 10% of the races are uncontested. You've got 90% of them are either uncontested or undercontested. So only a very small fraction of Americans get to vote in meaningful congressional
elections
every 2 years.
It's a very elite country club.
Yeah. That's what it is.
Well, and so, my I just want to comment one thing. My whole, that for the last 10 years, I've said, no more signs up. No more advertising on TV. Everybody complains about it anyway, that on cable and spectrum and so forth, that you're watching all of these. Let everybody, whoever's going to run for Congress, make them do it grassroots. Here's the money. This is the most money that you're allowed to spend. And don't litter our streets with all these signs and so forth. Make them work for it. You know, make them work for doing what they're supposed to do, because then it kind of evens the playing field a little bit.
A little bit
more, where people have to do town halls and have to participate in these things rather than just sort of sitting back and just showing up on election day because it's what their friend told them to do.
Well, yeah. It's all about the money. But yeah. Nick, so why is Congress so broken? Why is it so broken?
Well, I think it goes back to what we mentioned earlier, where members of Congress are so fixated on getting reelected that they lose sight of what their constituents want and what their constituents need. And the seniority system there is a big part of it. Let's say, for example, Sita, that you did run for Congress and, you know, you happen to be the needle in a haystack that manages to get through the 98% reelection rate for the incumbents, and you get in there. The first thing that's going to happen when you get to Washington, D.C. is the leadership is going to sit you down and they're going to say, look, this is how the game is played.
Orientation.
Yeah, you're going to get the talk. And the talk is, here's what you have to do. You need to keep your head down. You need to be a cog in the machine. You need to toe the party line. And if you just vote with leadership for 10 to 12 years, you know, maybe we'll give you a spot on a committee. And then maybe if you do it for 20 years, maybe you'll become the chair of that committee. And so it becomes all about climbing this ladder and pursuing more power.
Towing the line.
It does. And if you're somebody who has independent thoughts, those are banned in Congress.
We're done.
Don't you dare buck Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi or any of those leaders in there, or else you're going to get thrown off your committee and punished, and your constituents aren't going to get any scraps. So the system itself is corrupt because of seniority. And, you know, even the good people, even the people who have the right intentions who go to Congress, you know, by the time they go through that ringer, their spirit gets broken by that system and they lose sight of why they ran for office in the first place.
Right. So how would term limits help that? I mean, this is why it's fun that our show is fun and unscripted, because we can talk in a responsible way and get some information from our friend Nick Tambolides, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have term limits, how would it help?
Well, first of all, term limits would dismantle that entire seniority system, right? And right now, you've got people who are running committees in Washington, D.C., not because they're really smart or they have the expertise in that area, but because they've just been around for 40 years, because they have the most gray hairs.
They play the game.
Yeah, they know how to play the game.
They listened in orientation.
Yes, and they have towed the party line for 40 years. So term limits would totally dismantle that. It would return to more of a merit-based system. If nobody could stay for more than 6 or 8 years, you would get people who are a lot more public service-minded, who intend to do the right things, who don't care whether they lose their seats
because they knew that would happen anyway. But the argument would be, well, the newbies are coming in and they don't have the experience. How do you fight that?
Well, I look at what experience in Congress is right now, and I hate to dash anyone's hopes, but members of Congress are not reading the 1,000-page bills that we put on their desk. You know, I can give you an example. A couple weeks ago, Congressman Posey was given a coronavirus bill at midnight and then to read, and then he voted for it at 12:30. So he had 30 minutes to read over 200 pages of a bill and may not have even known what was in it. And that's sort of commonplace for members of Congress. Because
they have people to do their reading and just give them key points.
And this ties
but
back.
But in a half an hour?
Yeah.
This ties back to the why they're doing it in the first place. Because members of Congress spend on average 60 to 70% of their time raising money for their reelection rather than doing their jobs. It's amazing. If you actually go to Capitol Hill, you'll see they can't do it in their offices. But right down the street from the Capitol is a call center where members of Congress, they take a short stroll a couple blocks down, and they actually sit down in a cubicle like telemarketers, and they spend 5 hours a day on the phone begging donors for money, dialing for
that
dollars.
Sucks. So how do we get money out of politics?
Sure, they have experience, but it's the wrong experience. They are professional campaigners.
Right.
They are not
right.
statesmen. They are not real legislators. I think if you had term limits, you know, people would not worry so much about those consequences because they would know going in that this is going to be a finite amount of time, and then I have to go back and live under the laws I made.
And then maybe they'd spend that 5 hours a day reading.
Or maybe meeting
constituents.
Or meeting I was just going to say, having a town hall. Exactly. So, one of my good friends that I respect so much, Gary Schifrin, he wrote this on my comment about term limits.
Yes.
And I agree with him. This is one that I agree. He says he definitely have mixed feelings that if someone is doing a great job and they can't run because of term limits, it's a loss. On the other hand, if someone is not doing a great job and then term limits are good, like Mitch McConnell, if we have term limits for the president, why shouldn't we have term limits for all the others?
Right. Yeah.
So that's a very good comment.
But that's the whole piece, too, is the people that would be voted out in term limit situation that certainly could contribute in another way. And find other ways to contribute.
Oh, they contribute, all right. They lobby. But let me ask
Can we talk about that point for a second, though?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, what we like to say is the cream rises to the top. If you are a person who is in Congress and you really have a message that resonates with your constituents and you are highly respected in your community, then you don't need to rely on the power of incumbency and being a congressman to make a difference in your community. There are so many other ways that you can do it. So I don't think we're really losing all that much. But when you're talking about lobbyists, when a member of Congress right now retires, they do go over to K Street and they become a lobbyist and they make a lot more money.
I've heard a lot about K Street. I want to check it out one day. But really quick, because our time is running out, if we address term limits and we get somewhere with it, would it also address all this money in politics?
I think it would, because what you're looking at is creating these open seat elections. You know, right now, when an incumbent is running, they're either running unopposed. They might have one or two challengers who don't, unfortunately, have much hope of winning. But when you create an open seat, it is a lot less expensive to win an open seat. So you would be creating a situation where it costs a lot less money to run for office and win, because you don't need to overcome that tremendous high hurdle of beating an incumbent. When it's an open seat, it's sort of like a free-for-all. You see a dozen candidates run when a seat is open, and it costs, sometimes you can win a congressional seat with a couple $100,000 instead of $2.5 million. So you're automatically creating a much bigger talent pool that now have access to political
office.
And
people that actually care, because things change on the ground all the time. What's pressing today with COVID-19 showing the disparities between healthcare and wealthcare wasn't there 5 years ago.
Yeah.
5 years ago, they were probably talking about something else. So things change all the time, and you do need the newbies actually to come in.
And if more people had access to public service, then you would see people from a diverse walk of life running for office. You know, right now, a majority of Congress members, before they get to Congress, they're either lawyers or they're professional politicians. I mean, the Congress is disproportionately old, white, rich,
and male. How about the millionaires and billionaires?
It doesn't look like America at all.
Right, and they have a lot of millionaires and billionaires.
And even women. You know, women are half the population, but they're only about a quarter of Congress.
Because we can't win when your own friends and family tell you you can't win against an establishment candidate. It's just ingrained in a political system that you can't win.
So
people don't try anymore. So what is the plan to get term limits passed?
Let me just note real quick, there is a new paper by a professor at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts and Sciences that says term limits at the state level have led to a 33% increase in the emergence of female candidates, because when there are more open seats, more women run and they win, and women tend to have less linear career paths than men, and so they don't want to be career politicians. They find elected offices a lot more appealing when there are term limits. There is a roadmap to get this done. It has to be a constitutional amendment. You know, that can be either proposed by Congress, or it can be done by two-thirds of the state legislatures. I'm not holding my breath waiting on Congress to do it, because that's like getting chickens to vote for Colonel Sanders. It's very, very unlikely.
I was just going to say that doesn't sound
But funny. The state legislatures can do it. If 34 state legislatures say we want term limits on Congress, then they can get together and they can propose the amendment and nobody in Washington can stop it. So we're pursuing both approaches. And we've had a little bit of success so far. You know, we've passed this in the Florida legislature. We've passed it in two other states. There are 15 states that have called for an amendment writing convention that would include term limits. And so we are well on our way, but we need to rally the American people
I'm enjoying this conversation, because I can see both sides of this. I'm like Gary Schifrin. I mean, you know, but don't we already have a term limit called the election?
Ideally, that's what you would have, but practically speaking, it doesn't work out that way because incumbents have so much power and because they're so easily able to stack the deck. You know, like we said, incumbents have all the money. They have all the name recognition. They have all the free media coverage. They can actually spend money out of their office budgets, their taxpayer-funded budgets, on mail that it basically looks like campaign mailers. And so it is very difficult for any opponent to cut through that. We don't have free and fair elections because of the power of incumbency.
And the incumbents, they've been there so long, bouncing around like a ball from city council to county commission to senate to state to house, back again, that they know exactly what to say, to who to say it to, where to say it, and they know the right words to use to the right person. That's what I find in politics, whether it's on the Republican side or the Democratic side. I think that they become seasoned. They're like a well-oiled machine.
And, you know, that hurts a lot of people. You know, you were mentioning someone earlier in the broadcast that you spoke with who just had really no interest in politics. And they sounded kind of apathetic about it. Well, I would be apathetic about it, too, if I thought the system was completely rigged. You know, what is the point of going to vote when you see these numbers?
And a lot of people believe it's rigged. How do we change their minds, though? Because
60%, almost 70% of the people, right? 30% voter turnout. 70% of the people are already telling us by their actions that they don't think that
they can make a difference. To vote. We want them to get involved in the process. So how do you change that?
You get them more involved by making elections more competitive and more meaningful. You know, right now, when an incumbent has a stranglehold over a district, there's really no prayer for anyone else to sneak in and overcome that. It happens so seldomly. But when a seat is open, you get a host of different candidates from different backgrounds running, and you have real choice and diversity in that election.
Really,
so
quick, before we go, Nick, because I think we have a minute left.
Yeah.
You are wise beyond your years. I'm going to bring him back on because I like opening my mind, and I love learning things every day. I don't want to stay in one lane. I want to divert a little bit and learn about other things. You've been great. If somebody wants to find out a little bit about the U.S., what is
term
it?
Limits.
Term limits. Tell us where to find it.
I'll just say this. You know,
I don't know why I almost said U.S. history.
Well, it's both. U.S. history. George Washington was the father of term limits. I'll say this. You know, we're in a very divided political climate. Democrats and Republicans are at each other's throats all the time. This is the one issue that unites all Americans. 82% of Americans support this. Doesn't matter your political affiliation. Donald Trump and Barack Obama both support term limits. This is something that can bring people together, can start to heal our country. If you want to be a part of the movement, go to termlimits.com. Also, check out our podcast, No Uncertain Terms. Comes out every Monday on iTunes, Stitcher, all the major term limit platforms. Podcast platforms.
I
saw him on C-SPAN, and it was wonderful.
Another
so proud
wonderful edition of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, because we're going to lose our airtime here in just a second. Please tune in at 1 o'clock every Monday, where we have other great guests just like Nick and just like Beverly that joined us today. We'll see you next week, folks.
This is the Christian Voice of Brevard on WWBC 1510 AM.